in the morning. Present today are Senators Davis, Senator Stevens, and Senator Olson. We have two orders of business today. The first is bills previously heard that we're taking up again, SB 33. The sponsor staff is here. Diane Behrens is here. In everybody's packet is an amendment that is coming from the sponsor, and accompanying the amendment and just passed out is something that we can discuss once the amendment is offered. Can I get a motion to adopt the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt amendment number one.
Thank you. Amendment number one is to page 3, line 31. It's relatively simple, and it is to insert or the United States Department of Education. If Mr. Moll, can you come on up and be prepared for questions? My understanding of the amendment, and this gets to the handout that was just passed out. The handout was provided by the sponsor. The amendment has the effect of expanding eligible institutions that would not have been covered under the current language in the bill. And with that, I hesitate to go too much further because I can't speak to it probably like staff could. Could you identify yourself for the record and give us a brief explanation of the amendment?
Nick Moe, legislative aide, Senator Johnny Ellis. And we proposed this amendment because it wasn't our intent to leave out any vocational post-secondary institutions in Alaska, and by choosing only the one accreditation, we were leaving out the Career Academy, the Alaska Vocational Technical Center in Seward, and we wanted to make sure we included those because we feel that Senator Ellis feels that vocational schools are a very important part of Alaska and should be included in this scholarship grant.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at, as you're expanding these institutions that can participate, are you allowing to go ahead and have private VOTEC schools in there as well?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, with the expansion of institutions, we are including the tech school in Seward and the Career Academy in Anchorage. And that fits under the accreditation of the United States Department of Education. So if there's other private schools that you have in mind, we'd certainly look into that.
So you don't know if the Mr. Chairman, if I could, you don't know if the private institutions are indeed covered at this time.
But before through the chair, before the amendment.
Well, even after the amendment, just want to know if a person's going to a private. Mm-hmm. VOTEC school or accredited school that he's eligible for this.
Yeah, currently on the list, I believe you have. Okay. Pardon. Oh, Mr. Chair. Currently on the list that you have are all the institutions that legislative research got to me for the institutions that are included in the grant.
Mm-hmm.
So at this time, I believe no other ones would be included.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Davis.
Wouldn't the Career Academy be considered a private? So we do have it included in here. So if you need to adjust the language to say that if there is no, the name is not on here, it would be acceptable. Mm-hmm. Because you do have one on here at least.
Mm-hmm.
Can I invite Ms. Behrens up also? Because I have a feeling she may be able to add something. Yeah, you can share the podium there.
Okay.
Ms. Behrens, if you could identify yourself for the record, and I guess the question is, and perhaps some of my confusion and some of the other confusion is, the list that has been passed out is a list of additional schools that would qualify, and I suspect that there are vocational schools that already qualified under the existing language. So this is not a comprehensive list of the vocational tech institutions. Is that correct?
For the record, this is Diane Behrens, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The effect of the change is to include sort of non-collegiate programs. The current language is an accreditor that doesn't actually look at certain nationally accredited type schools. So by referencing the U.S. Department of Education approval, you have broadened it to include those one-year type training programs, regardless of whether they're public or private. So it's all inclusive.
Great. Thank you.
And just another question, and you may or may not know the answer, Ms. Behrens. I mean, the structure of this scholarship program provides a certain amount of money will be divided up, and there's a pro rata formula that can also come in. I mean, how many students are we adding by adding by adopting this amendment and adding these institutions? Do you have any idea at all?
Mr. Chair, I don't expect this would substantially increase the pool. About 90% of students in Alaska attend the University of Alaska. They were already there. This simply, for instance, enrollments at Seward are rarely above 300, assuming every student would a year would be included. Career Academy probably has similar enrollment. Their programs are slightly shorter, so the numbers may be higher than that, but it is not a substantial expansion of the pool.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at this expansion of the number of schools there, kind of a follow-up to the chairman's question, what does it do to the fiscal note that's there? I see it's $25 million. Does that change it at all?
If I could, through the chair, Senator Olson, the $25 million fiscal note. Are you referring to the Department of or Commissioner of Revenue?
I guess I am. Yes, that's the only one that I saw. Otherwise,
yeah.
Everything.
Because currently we don't have any appropriations to this fund. This bill is just creating the endowment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that if there's a fiscal note in there, that's just to gauge if that amount of money was available, how much resources it would take the Commissioner of Revenue to manage a fund of that size. So currently we don't have any specific number on appropriations as of now, so we can't really estimate how many students would be included in the program as of this time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and let the record reflect that we've been joined by Senator Huggins. Are there, Senator Huggins, we have a motion in front of us. There, you should have an amendment as part of your packet now to page 3, line 31. A motion has been made to adopt the amendment. We've been discussing the amendment. The net effect of the amendment can probably best be articulated through the handout here that you have in front of you. It adds these institutions to the eligible institutions for the scholarship program. Are there further questions, further discussion on the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment's adopted. And Mr. Moe, Ms. Behrens, I appreciate both of you being back. I mean, we have it's sometimes difficult when you have a committee slot that is for an hour, and we have bifurcated both last hour and this hour into two components, one an overview component, the other dedicated to this bill. And so I don't think we've had time for a good set of questions, and I'd like to move discussion to the full bill and see if there are any issues that committee members want clarified before we take action on the bill. Are there any questions of the sponsor or Ms. Behrens? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I missed the last hearing, but I think one of the big issues to me in the past is I've looked at aid Alaska gives to students. We haven't really done a great job in terms of those students with financial need, and I ask if Ms. Behrens could address how does this help address that problem, just in general terms. So.
Ms. Behrens.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, what I see as most advantageous to this, should an endowment be funded, is the ability to communicate to students early on that they're, especially those at-risk, low-income students, that there is a fund source that's there. One of the challenges with our current needs-based grant program, it's quite modestly funded, is that it is, the funding source is not necessarily dependable. The Student Loan Corporation has some unpledged earnings that it's able to apply to that, to about $500,000 a year. Last year, we were able to get some money in the capital budget to increase the amount we were able to make, but that year-to-year structure really doesn't allow you to talk to junior high kids about how important it is that they buckle down and get good grades, because there is a program there for them. So I think it's the ability to commit early to students that there's a well-funded program that is available to them.
Additional questions? If not, I have a few questions. And they're mostly mechanical, and I just ask whoever wants to ask a question to identify themselves for the record again, since we have two people at the microphone. I suspect that we'll be able to parse out who it was, because you both have recognizable voices. But the first is, I mean, I'm assuming that this program is additive. And in that sense, I mean, it's another program that adds on to the Alaska Scholars program, where the top 10% of the graduating students are eligible for the program as they enter the University of Alaska. Is that assumption right? And if it is right, how does that work in the determination of need? Are the tuition costs just subtracted from the other costs as you determine eligibility for this program?
Sure. Nick Moe here, legislative aide, Senator Joni Ellis. Mr. Chair, there is a UA Scholars program, and as you said, it is a top 10%, but there are those students who do achieve a very high grade point average that still fall between the gap of getting the UA Scholars program and qualifying for financial grants, such as a Pell Grant or other scholarships that they would be entitled to if they had either a lower income or if other variables were there. So I think this is a good complement to that program. It is a separate entity. A separate scholarship fund other than the UA grants program, but I believe there's large need for this, because we're not only requiring students to show merit-based achievement, we're requiring them to show financial need. So if we're not giving this to students who don't have unmet financial needs, so they need to show that they have at least $4,000 of unmet financial need before they're eligible. So I think there's a large gap there, and from the statistics we have, the average yearly tuition in the university system is right around $12,000. So over 4 years, that not only multiplies, there's a large gap. Even if a student saves all their dividends, even if they apply for all the financial aid they can get, there's still this very large disparity, even if they're doing very well in school. So I think that.
Senator Stevens.
Could I follow up on that just a little bit? My Rotary Club at home, we always give scholarships to local high school students, and one is for academic, and then one for years was for financial need. And I was a little embarrassed when you go to graduation and you say, well, this kid come up here, you're getting a scholarship for financial need. It sort of says, I don't think it's good to do that. So are we actually publicizing that we're giving this kid a scholarship because he's broke, or can we make that a little more palatable?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I don't think many college students out there would be shy to receive money for their unmet financial need. I don't think it would be on a podium such as that for this particular scholarship bill. But that is a good concern. But I think many college students. Currently, because this doesn't only apply to high school students, but community-based students as well, I think they would be happy to announce that they've that they get this financial needs scholarship because they've earned it. They've received the B average or better as well. So
I agree with you, but still, I think that when you present this, you could make it a little more palatable if it's, say, at graduation, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a way to do that that is not in your face, you know.
Ms. Behrens.
Diane Behrens, for the record. Mr. Chair, I would like to note for the record that the commission does have the ability to promulgate, under the proposed language, promulgate regulations. It would certainly be our intent that regulations would indicate that this money not displace other non-loan aid. So if a student happened to have sufficient scholarships prior to this, that would eliminate their gap between the money available and the cost of education, that they would not qualify for this. In discussion with the University of Alaska student leadership, they felt that it was important that students invest in their own education, and it was their suggestion that they have at least a $4,000 need in the language of the bill. So they understood that if you have limited funds, you want to make sure that those with the academic prowess and the most need be first in line for those monies. So that's where we got to the language that was in the original bill.
Senator Stevens.
I can call a follow-up on the same question to Diane. So as far as the student knows, I mean, we need to know how much money is going out for academic achievement, how much money for financial need. But how does that scholarship the student, what does that scholarship the student receive look like? Does it say you've received this scholarship because of financial need, or is that acknowledged, or can it just be a scholarship from your commission?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, mechanically what I would envision is that they would receive the notice through their financial letter of award of financial aid from the institution. So it would appear as we're not sure whether we're going to pronounce it an Alaska ACES award or Alaska ICE award or what we're going to do, but that would be a scholarship award that would appear in their financial aid letter. It wouldn't be a grant necessarily, yeah, because they not only have to demonstrate the need, they have to demonstrate the academic performance as well. And if I could just add, I think it will be important to emphasize that to them, because as Nick explains to me, under this bill, they will have to continue to perform at an academic level in order to qualify this from 1 year to the next.
That was the next question, and perhaps you can explain the mechanics of that. I mean, one of the questions that arose, and it didn't arise from me. I wish I had thought of it, but I mean, how do you make sure that a person who got the scholarship in the first year deserves it in the second or third year? I mean, what kind of performance standards does a student have to demonstrate once they get into college to continue to get the?
Nick Moe here, Mr. Chair. I forget what exactly what section it looks here.
Page
looks like
two,
here on
line 24.
Yeah, page 2, line 24, in section 2, it says a student must achieve a cumulative grade point average of 3.0 or higher on a scale of 4.0 or the equivalent at a school in which the applicant is currently enrolled. So just as Diane stated, the student must demonstrate they must demonstrate the achievement in performance in school while they're getting the scholarship. So they must maintain that B average or better during college, and as well, we require that they try to graduate within 5 years, and so we're not going to give the grant to students who are staying, you know, 6-7 years. We want to make sure that they're performing good and that they graduate in a timely fashion.
I don't want to sound too suspicious, so a follow-up question. I mean, the language is or the equivalent at the school in which the applicant is currently enrolled. Does this mean that if I start out at APU, I have a 2.8 grade point average, and I transfer to UAA, that I could then requalify myself for the scholarship?
Mr. Chair, I'm on that question. I think that they would probably need to get the 3.0 or demonstrate that they have the 3.0, because just in that example, I think APU does have the 4.0 grade point scale. But I think that language is there because some vocational or tech schools might not have a traditional grading system, and we want to make sure we can rate performance on those too and not exclude them.
And perhaps Ms. Behrens can address this question also. I mean, I hate to put it in totally negative terms, but so I'll put it in a positive term also. Let's assume that the student wants to transition from one of the smaller schools. For example, one of the smaller schools we've just added through the amendment wants to transition from that smaller school to UAF. With this language, would they be precluded from applying for the scholarship in the next year at the new school?
Mr. Chair, this is Diane Behrens. They would not, the financial aid professionals would have to be able to certify that they qualify with a 3.0 GPA. So I believe they would have to attend for two terms until they have a two-term GPA in order to be certified according to standard financial aid practices. Unless somehow the school created a grade point average. I mean, typically, as I understand it, you can transfer credits, but you don't transfer necessarily the grades that were accompanied those. So I believe they would have to establish a, under this language, a GPA at the school in which they're currently enrolled.
So if for example, the language was if, for example, on line 26, page 2, if you just struck the end of the sentence, struck at the school in which the applicant is currently enrolled, that would then not be a problem for a student who wanted to transfer from perhaps the Elmendorf School to UAF. They would be allowed to do that if that language was struck, but would not be allowed to do it if, in fact, that language was retained?
Mr. Chair, and just to clarify, the school from which they are transferring, at that school they had an eligible GPA. The presumption is that the prior school they had an eligible GPA of 3.0 or better.
I may be confusing myself. I thought you said the credits transfer, but not the GPA.
Right, but if you strike the end of the sentence ending it at 4.0, and at APU they had a 3.0 or better GPA, and now they're going to UAF where they don't have a separate GPA, I think they would then qualify because the school could reference the GPA at the school from which they're transferring and verify that they in fact had that qualifying GPA. So there would not be a break in their eligibility in that case. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I just a follow-up question. I mean, the issue, is the issue whether the institution certifies what the previous GPA is, or is the issue whether your commission does it?
Mr. Chair, the efficiencies in financial aid administration are created by a partnership between the commission and the institution. We do not collect transcripts. We do not review transcripts. We rely on an agreement with the financial aid office at the institution to certify all of that. It's done electronically. We would not be interested in getting into the business of collecting and reviewing that sort of data.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Stevens.
I think I understand that. And it's just a follow-up. I think part of the problem might be the term enrolled. Enrolled simply means that you may not be taking classes yet, but you have filled out the paperwork and you've been accepted. Is that what your definition of enrolled is, Ms. Behrens? Just you enrolled simply means you. Well, am I right? You don't have to be taking classes at the time. You've applied for application, or you've applied for acceptance. It's in that process. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct.
Another question. I'm on page 3, beginning on line 29. Is that definition on a qualifying post-secondary institution, does that preclude an Alaska student who wants to participate in the WAMI program from getting a scholarship? If the WAMI program requires they go to the University of Washington, for example?
Mr. Chair, I believe this is only for undergraduate study, but that question has not come up. So at least it was my presumption it was for undergraduate study, but I don't see that limitation in the language. So as I would read this, no. Alaska WAMI is an Alaska program.
Even though the institution that they may be attending is outside the state?
In that particular instance, that would be correct.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Moe.
This, for that program, I don't believe it would qualify, since this is only for those post-secondary institutions within the state of Alaska. So I believe that would be a separate program. It would not apply in this.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Olson, Senator Olson.
Under the WAMI program, though, they do have times where they actually are taking classes up here, and some of their clinical years are done up here as well. And obviously, it's a great expense to go to medical school, and are under the numbers that are out there as far as physicians are there. So, I guess it would be a help if I think to those. Having gone to medical school and realized the debt you come out of, it's even worse now. I'd certainly be in favor of reconsidering that.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Olson, I do believe that in taking undergraduate schools in Alaska, that they would qualify for this, since if they are Alaskan and they are taking undergraduate schools and they do have the unmet financial need, and show the merit of achieving a B average or better, I don't see why they wouldn't qualify for this staying in Alaska. But once they do go out of Alaska to University of Washington, I don't think they would be able to receive funds there. But I do believe, as the language currently states, that they would, if they demonstrate all of the requirements, that they would get assistance in Alaska doing their prerequisites here in the state.
Mr. Chairman, the last question I guess I have is it Ms. Behrens has said that it may be just an undergraduate that are the ones eligible for this, and WAMI is obviously a graduate program. Is your understanding that a graduate school is also eligible, graduate students?
Mr. Moe.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Olson. I'll be honest that I haven't considered that. I had in my mind that it was an undergraduate program.
Sure.
So I can't answer it at this time, but I'll be sure to get back to the committee on it.
We're holding the bill anyway, Mr. Chairman.
I think we probably should. Senator Olson. And we are running into the time for the second part of the meeting.
Before you close it out,
Senator Davis.
I'm looking at the 3.0 that you have to have in order to qualify for this program, and I think that's good. We have a scholars program that already covers that. This is supposed to be for scholars as well as those with need money. I would like to see that be a 2.5. 2.5 is not a B average, it's a C plus, and everybody can't be B students. And if you want to really help kids that have the needs and doing well in school, I don't think that the 3.0 is necessary for this particular program. We don't have enough money out there for the kids now that needs money to go to school. And to tie that in there and say it has to be a 3.0, you have to carry it the full time. And if you're saying you got to wait a full two semesters, before you could even qualify for it if you were already in a school and transferred, because you have nothing to bring you forward with the B average. I was going to mention that maybe we should consider lowering that, and since we're going to hold it anyway, that'll give us time to think about that.
Absolutely. I think you need to be prepared. I'm going to cut us off here because we're cutting into somebody else's time. But let's be prepared to discuss that issue, the graduate school issue, and it would be helpful to the committee if you could also do one more thing, and probably you, Ms. Behrens. On page 2, you reference the free application for federal student aid. It might be helpful to know what the parameters, what the recipe is for that, as well as the reference to 20 U.S.C. 1070C-2 as amended, so that we understand not that that is the rule, but what the rules are. With that, we'll set the bill aside, and we'll reference it as Bill previously heard at a future meeting. Thank you. And is Mr. Herman going to be the okay?
You have at ease or anything?
You want to? We're back on the record. Thank you for your patience. We're running about 5 minutes late, as you can tell by the discussion we had during the at ease. A bill in front of us that engaged the mind, and so that has that I guess will suffice for my apology to folks from the Mental Health Trust. If you could identify yourself for the record and please begin.
Hi, I'm Bill Herman. I work for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Let me use the microphone here. And I'm second string. Jeff Jesse's supposed to be here, but he's down with Representative Seaton's Committee on Education, and he'll be up here in a minute, so I'll probably hand it off to him at some point, but I don't want to delay your proceedings here. I also have a couple of other guests that I'll introduce at the end here, and a couple of kids that have gone through treatment and those kinds of things. The presentation here starts out a little bit about social services issues, and then it'll become apparent how it relates to education as we move along.
And Mr. Herman, as you begin, three of us have another committee meeting at 9, so you might just keep that in mind as you go through. We have a very experienced committee, so some of this will not be new information.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Herman.
Okay. The first slide is exponential growth. Of what's happened to the number of kids that are being sent out of state to residential psychiatric treatment centers from FY98 through FY04. That's slide number 2.
Yeah. We have slides in front of us, but we also have slides up here. Projected?
The jump drive that I have is an out-of-date version of this, So rather than use an out-of-date version, I'd rather go with the paper, if that's
okay.
All right with
you. That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Herman.
So you can see on slide 2 that it's really growing exponentially. That's why we started the Bring the Kids Home effort in cooperation with the Murkowski administration back in 2005, fiscal year 2005. And then on slide 3, you'll notice that we have kind of broken the back of that trend of having more and more kids going out of state. That wasn't good for the kids or for the state, really. There were $40 million that were going out of state with them. Wasn't good for the families either. So what we wanted to do was bring the kids back home. and also keep kids from going out. So it's really kind of a misnomer that bring the kids home is called what it is. It should be bringing and keeping the kids home. We went from having the number of admissions in FY04 being at 571 down to the census today is 164 kids out of state, and our goal is to get it well below 100 with just the kinds of kids that have special needs that the economy of scale doesn't work well in Alaska. So we've been pretty successful in getting this broken, but what this does mean is that we're going to end up with more kids in our home systems and in our home schools, and that's where it kind of comes in relevant to this committee. On slide 4, this kind of shows what we've been hoping to partner with the legislature on. Is if you can see in FY05, we had the bottom bar, the lighter gray bar, is the amount of money that's being spent out of state to residential psychiatric treatment centers. The top darker portion of that bar is the amount of money that we've been spending in state for residential psychiatric treatment centers. And we want to see a shifting of the money going from out-of-state expensive facilities with expensive day rates to home and community-based services with much lower cost per student or per youth, and much more effective services because you involve the family. So that's kind of our goal, is to re-engineer that money into those services.
Mr. Herman, are you comfortable with people breaking in?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Could you just briefly explain on the chart on page 4, how many of those dollars are federal dollars? How many of those dollars are general fund dollars? I guess what I'm trying to get to is an economics question. Are we importing federal dollars to the state through this program? And if so,
we are to some extent. The kids that are non-native, not Alaska Native, will receive, if they're in a Medicaid eligible program, they'll receive 50% of the funding from the federal Medicaid. And then we match it with a general fund dollar, Medicaid dollar.
Thank you.
But 40% of the kids that were going to out-of-state facilities at the beginning of this project were Alaska Native, so they could be funded at 100% if we had the right health corporations and other organizations providing the services. That's another goal of our project, is to maximize that too. On slide 5, you'll see here that we've been doing some research with the Medicaid MIS system about how many kids have an individualized education program and who are special ed and those that are not. And if you can see, these are percentages here for the different regions that we've broken it into. On slide 5, there's quite a variation of the amount of IEP kids with non-IEP kids. You can see Anchorage is about 50%, whereas Mat-Su, you've got a much higher percentage with no individual education plan. And so we're wondering about these variations. Why is there such a strong regional variation? Are we missing kids? It's surprising to us, kind of being more familiar with health and social services, why a kid who is dysfunctional enough to be sent to a residential psychiatric treatment center out of state wouldn't have difficulty with their educational progress while going through the kind of trauma that you have to be at that level of care in out of state. So we want to look at that and see what are the issues, how is it related to educational needs and stuff. The other thing that we need to be concerned about is that the youth has kind of three environments that they're working in every day, that they're in every day: home, environment, community, and then school. And of course, most of their waking hours are in the school. So we need to make sure that when we bring kids home from some kind of residential care, that we have a sufficient services to support their recovery and maintain their recovery. We've got a few programs that will provide that for us, and we'll talk about those in a minute. How are we doing here? So far, so good. When we realize the importance of education, this interface between education and social services, we know that, you know, schools already have plenty of things to do in the school day, but what we're trying to do is set up a situation whereby kids that are having difficulty learning, to provide the interventions and the help to within that school day to make it possible for them to be more successful. So we've created an education subcommittee that has both the chairs of Department of Health and Social, Commissioner, excuse me, of Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education and Early Development. And you can see the goals that we have here. We've monitored, we've just begun to implement three projects that you see numbered 1, 2, and 3 on that slide. And we'll explain more about that in a minute. It's a siloed situation. We're trying to get really two worlds to begin to speak to each other and understand each other's needs. And that's why we felt we needed to have kind of the commissioner level leadership of this.
Mr. Herman, you spoke to the silo. I mean, I guess, and you can get back to the committee on this. Both slides 5 and 6, it makes financial sense for a school district to develop IEPs for these students, doesn't it? I mean, aren't they being reimbursed more through the foundation formula for a student with an IEP?
Yeah, Commissioner Ledoux has talked to us about the increases in intensive needs kids. I'm not sure the exact title of the program, but that you guys have a multiplier that has been approved that should help out in this situation.
It helps out if the students are identified.
Yeah,
it doesn't help out if they're not
identified. We're still learning about the education system because, frankly, the trust, we're pretty familiar with the social services side of things, okay. And we're just beginning to learn the educational side of it.
Thank you, Mr. Herman.
On slide 7, you'll see the membership here. We've tried to really include key people in the system. Jeff Jesse tells the story about sitting down with Superintendent Carol Como and saying, we've got it figured out that there's about 350 kids that when we get this program working effectively that will now be back in your school district. And these kids are going to be intensive needs kids. That's going to really bump up their special ed environment, their needs for accommodating those kids. And so that was really kind of a startling number of kids for her to think about accommodating as the situation changes. Well, I've got, we had some providers too that we hoped could speak to you, but they're still down with Representative Seaton's committee, the House Education Committee. So I think I'll go and describe some of the efforts that we're doing right now. Slide 8, we have a total of $450,000 that's been approved by the legislature over the last couple of years for three initiatives. This was just our first effort at trying to understand what's going on, try some approaches here that would help with the issue and teach us more about what's the situation. The first was we found that this program, the Positive Behavioral Supports, is a program that's been used around in other states. And we contracted with the Center for Human Development at the University of Alaska Anchorage to help us with this. And what it is basically first improving the school-wide environment so that there's less bullying, a better environment here for kids to who maybe are somewhat unstable because of their emotional disturbances, to have a better supportive environment for that. Got other folks coming here? Okay, great. Can I invite
Absolutely, and if you could introduce them quickly for the record.
Let's see, let's get at least two chairs up here and then we'll kind of rotate you through. Kelly, we're talking about your program.
Oh, great.
I'd like to introduce Kelly Donnelly. She's works for the Center for Human Development, and I'll let her describe this project. We're talking about positive behavioral supports right now.
And Kelly, just before you begin, we have to end the meeting at 9, and so we have a time constraint.
Thank you, and my apologies on behalf of my partners for our delay. We were kind of held up in another committee meeting.
I told them twice already.
Sorry.
You're we knew some time. Go.
We knew you were on a tight timeline. So the Center for Human Development
For the record, your name is?
I'm sorry. Kelly Donnelly. I'm the Director of Children's Behavioral Health and Advocacy Programs at the UAA Center for Human Development.
Thank you, Kelly.
We have a number of positive behavioral health programs that we have engaged in over a number of years at the center. The one that's supported right now by Bring the Kids Home is a concerted effort to bring community resources to the schools in support of these kids with very difficult behaviors and the kids who are at risk of demonstrating very difficult behaviors. It's that recognition that schools cannot be all do all, and we need to have effective community partnerships. So this year there's a pilot program going on in four communities, Sitka, Ketchikan, Juneau, and Dillingham, that has specific training around a three-tier approach to positive behavioral supports for community mental health and developmental disability providers. The intention is to have those community providers work explicitly with school districts to promote universal interventions, which simply means we've got clear expectations and environments that support positive social emotional outcomes for all kids, that we look at secondary interventions, the kinds of things that are going to help a smaller group of kids who are acting out, who are doing some things that cause problems at schools, but they don't reach the level where you would need to do a significant intervention plan, individualized plan. And then for that small segment of kids that's the top of the pyramid, the kids who cause the biggest drain on school systems, that create some of the highest levels of conflict in communities, working with providers and schools to develop person-centered, data-driven, individualized support plans to help those kids be successful. It's a pilot this year in those four communities. We're hoping to have some data that we can share with you in subsequent sessions to let you know how well this is working. But again, it's really trying to build that collaboration between schools and communities. So,
thank you, Kelly.
Is that brief enough?
Yes, that was great. Thank you.
Why don't we get our next person up? While Lori's coming up, I'd like you to move to slide 9, and it shows another effort that we have here. We have a contractor that's helping school districts bill for Medicaid services. There are school-based Medicaid services that extend schools' ability to find sources of funding for these special services that they need. It's an underutilized capability. A funding source that we've got a contractor that's had experience with this type of funding in other states and is coming now and helping districts. We're finding they're very positive about the idea of trying to build this. They've estimated that just in the initial kind of survey scan of the state that it can generate a potential $3.3 million of new revenue for the schools. So that's just another area that we're working on right now. And then I'd like to introduce Lori Roth. She's an employee of the Special Ed Services Agency.
Hi.
Bill, if you could maybe move the microphone a little bit closer. And Lori, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Hi. As Bill said, my name is Lori Roth. I'm the director of Special Education Service Agency. Our office is located in Anchorage, but basically we service statewide. I came up here in 1998, and this is one of the reasons why this project is a special passion of mine as an emotional disturbance specialist. So back in 98, I was already traveling statewide and seeing the effects of students coming home from residential psychiatric treatment facilities without their educational documentation. Students were coming home, landing on the plane on Friday, in the village Saturday, Sunday, coming to school on Monday because the RPTC told the parents, "Don't forget to register Johnny on Monday." So the parents did what they were asked to do. They took Johnny to school, but they didn't realize that there was a lot of paperwork that was missing. So Johnny came to school, and usually one of two things happens. Either the school will have Johnny stay, or the school might, depending on if they're concerned, if there's information that's missing, they might ask the parent, "Can you take Johnny home today? And we want to find out if we can get some documentation and some records on Johnny." So in this case, Johnny stayed in school, and the teacher was very stressed out. The principal was stressed out because Johnny was out of the village for 2 years. Johnny left when he was in fifth grade and came back when he was in seventh. So what they tried to do was kind of piece his educational history together. So they went to the main office, got whatever documents they had from his time in the village. They weren't very helpful because they were 2 years old. So what they had to do was they started assessing him informally, interacting with peers, his academics, put a program together, found out that Johnny probably had some kind of a developmental delay. Now, that kind of information would have came along with his educational records had this program existed years ago that Bill is very much in support of. Because one of our charges is to work with the RPTCs, transition these educational records. Now, when we called the RPTCs, they say we do that. And you know what? In all honesty, they do. Most of them have an educational transition person. But what I'm finding is the definition of transition is very different in one set of eyes than in another set of eyes. Transition isn't always giving the parents a phone number and saying, register Johnny on Monday. Transition is providing the parents as well as the school support to have the documents transition from the RPTC to the school and then making sure the records get to the right person. Because that's a thing that we're finding on this end that is a problem. Because even if in a city school, the parents may go to the wrong school. Because if you think about it with your children, registration is usually at the main office or the administrative building. Now, if you're in Anchorage or in Juneau, that's a drive across town. If you're in a Bush school district that's the size of Kansas or Rhode Island, that's a plane ride. So chances are Johnny's going to go to the village school. Now, we all know about the transition issues of staff in the village schools. So chances are the aide probably remembers Johnny. The last thing that the peers remember was the day that Johnny probably left, which wasn't a real good experience for them. Now, the staff in the school couldn't work with the peers because they didn't know Johnny was coming. The principal couldn't work with the teachers because he didn't know Johnny was coming. And the parents couldn't get the educational records because they may not have known what to ask for. So what we're finding is we're working with the RPTCs and the school districts to facilitate the transferring of the educational documentation. And we're also, as we're going through this process, documenting the things that are working and aren't working at the present time and within the present system. And then what we're doing is we're reporting back to the Mental Health Trust Educational Subcommittee and formulating plans so that these kids don't fall through the cracks. Thank you,
Lori. And Bill, you can help us out over the next 5 minutes on prioritization here. I'd hate to prioritize simply by time running out.
Let me just, Dee, I'll describe your program real quickly, and then we'll move into the youth, if that's okay. Thank you.
On slide, obviously there's not a number there. It's the next slide, which would be slide 10. It says, enhancing support at community schools. Dee Foster is here. She manages a program called the Little Tykes Program. And that's not the correct amount of the annual grant. It's $123,000. But what they are working on is that oftentimes there are root causes to serious emotional disturbances. You can see them there. And that they're working with kids to at an early age to avoid further problems later on. So this is kind of our efforts to work intervening earlier and younger to prevent problems that could potentially develop. What we've had then is we've got, we don't have it in these slides, but we've been able to save a significant amount of funding by avoiding residential care at later points. And then on slide 11 and 12, those are just our funding recommendations for this year. You'll see we're trying to enhance home and community-based services, and you can see the two bolded ones that are related to this effort. We're asking for no increments from general fund right at this point. The trust is continuing to partner on these until we can prove out these programs and see if we want to get them into the base at a later point. I'd like to ask, we've got a couple of students here, young persons that have been through this and experienced this, and maybe just have each one of them speak for a minute each, if that's okay.
That's great. I think it may bump us from concept to reality.
Yeah. I'll let them introduce themselves.
If each of you could just be, as you begin speaking, just identify yourselves for the record, that'd be great.
For the record, my name is Kareem Noel. I apologize for reading mine to you. This is my first time. I know it's unprofessional to do so.
You're going to do fine, and you're doing exactly what some legislators do, so right. Don't worry about that.
All right. So I just turned 18 years old, and I work for an organization called AYFN, Alaska Youth and Family Network. I'm a youth navigator. I was a foster child for 11 years. I was placed in North Star 20 times, and I was in residential treatment center for 2.5 years. Because of my situation, I was denied the opportunity to receive the education I am entitled to. I was told by many people in the system that I would be nobody and never be successful in my life because of this. But here I am, almost 3 years later, out of the system and off of medication. And because of the strength of my strength and the support of my foster parents and the friends I was able to because of the strength and support from my foster family and my friends, I was able to overcome my situation. Through the support I received from AYFM, I am continuing to be successful to this day. I now see my life has value and I can contribute to my community. I'm here to ask you to continue to fund this Bring the Kids Home initiative, increase funding for community-based organizations like AYFN, so that youth and families like mine can be successful and rebuild their lives and relationships with others. I think that maybe if we had organizations like Alaska Youth and Family Network while I was growing up, my family might still be together and I wouldn't be separated from my siblings, and just maybe my biological mother would still be alive if we had more organizations like this. And I would like to apologize once more for reading my statement to you guys. And I would like to thank you for your time today. And the next time I'm here, I will say my statement by heart.
You did a great job, and you did. If you spent more days in the Capitol building, you could grade yourself on the curve, and you're on the upside of the curve for your presentation.
Thank you.
And you've all been very kind in apologizing to us, and it's my turn to apologize to you. Three of us have a Finance Committee meeting that began about a minute ago, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to the Vice Chair, and the members who are able to stay will stay. And my apologies to you. I apologize to you. I mean, the charge of the two senators that are going to stay will be to brief us on what we missed. And so, again, thank you very much for being here. And starting a discussion that I think we all need to have. With that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Senator Davis. And the members of Finance are excused for the record. Thank you very much.
Just to brief at ease while then they leave.
For the record, I'm Carla Nikolai, and I'm affiliated with Alaska Youth and Family Network. Let me just say that I appreciate the opportunity to speak here, because I feel like, along with Cream here, I have a lot to say. I can say that I had the opportunity to go through the education system with not only one, but multiple mental health diagnoses. And let me just say it was a struggle. And not only was I defined and characterized by my diagnoses, I wasn't given the opportunity to been able to get an IEP. And so I felt that maybe I could help other youth who are in the same situation that I have been to get the education and the services they need by sharing my story and help preparing them for theirs. So, and that's how come I've become a youth navigator, and I work out in the Mattsu Valley, where you could see one of the slides in the wonderful presentation that Bill Herman gave was that the Matsu Valley doesn't have a lot of IEPs, and it hits really hard for me because I was one of those youth who didn't have an IEP. But now we're advocating for that, and it breaks my heart to see that it's me personally. And I, now that I've become a youth navigator, I help them, help youth to get what they want set in their own IEP where I didn't have a chance to. In a system that only 40% of youth that graduated high school, only 20% entered college, in the foster care system, that I'm really sorry.
It's quite okay.
I'm really sorry.
It's okay.
It's just, I really appreciate this effort.
While she composes herself there, could you tell me how many navigators you have in the program at this time? Anybody in the room?
We have 4 youth navigators.
40?
4.
4.
Youth navigators and 8 adult navigators.
Okay.
You're doing great.
All right. You're fine. You want to continue?
Yeah, I would love to continue.
Okay.
It's just that having a community-based service such as Alaska Youth and Family Network, I was able to become successful and graduate high school, to go to college, pursue my life dream to help others who have been in the situation I've gone through. And I've also realized, firsthand experiencing this, this whole effort, is that youth navigation and community-based services is not a hand up, but a hand up. And I would like to ask from the bottom of my heart to please continue and increase community-based services, which includes AYFN, to help youth continue to get the hand up and become successful, because I was most definitely blessed.
Thank you. Very good. Very good. Thank you for your comments. Is there other students to speak? Who's in charge? Is there anyone else going to speak? Does that complete?
That's it.
Okay. We want to say that we appreciate you coming, and many of the programs that you're concerned about, we are in the process of working on them now. You know, we're doing the budget now. So it's a good time to give you input. And I want you to look at that foster care bill that we have hanging out there on both sides. I think you'd be very happy if you see that, and if it passes, it's going to really help you in your program also. So we thank you for coming, and sorry we don't have any more time. We'll adjourn at this time at 10 after 9. Thank you.